The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Hey, you guys. Before we get started with this episode, we've got some exciting news to share with you. If you love the American Hauntings podcast, then this is your chance to be a part of it. During every episode, we mention that the podcast is just one part of American Hauntings. All of our books and our tours and our ghost hunts and events. And recently, we launched a brand new community on Patreon that gives you the chance to become an American Hauntings VIP. If you decide to do this, we've got tons of rewards. I get to send you all kinds of stuff in the mail, decals, buttons, shirts, all that good stuff. But we're going beyond that. So some of the reward levels include things like discounts from our online store, early access to events, private paranormal meetups at haunted places around the country, private ghost hunts, lectures, tours, even dinners, just for our subscribers. We're also gonna send you exclusive, privately printed books by Troy Taylor, not available to the public. And since you're a VIP, you're going to have free access to some of our events, including the Haunted America Conference. We're also including bonus episodes of this podcast, for subscribers only. So if you're one of those listeners who wishes the podcast was every week, this is your chance for new shows each week. Now, one of our goals is to try to upgrade the equipment that we use to produce the podcast. So as a listener, this is your chance to help us and to be a part of American Hauntings history. To get involved, just go to patreon.com/AmericanHauntings or see the show info for the link. We hope to see you at one of our private subscriber events in the near future. To get involved, just go to patreon.com/AmericanHauntings or just see the show info for the link. Now, on with the show.
Bonnie had only been working at the Lint Mansion restaurant for a few weeks when she saw the ghost for the first, and what turned out to be, the last time. She had heard all the ghost stories from the other staff members, and she'd seen the stories in the newspapers, but who believed those kind of things? She was sure it was all just for the publicity. A house that had the kind of history that the Lint Mansion did was a great setting for Halloween spookiness, but no one over the age of 12 actually believed any of those stories were true. Bonnie certainly didn't. It was all a bunch of nonsense. It was Sunday morning, and the staff was setting up for the restaurant's famous family-styled fried chicken dinner. It was a bright summer morning. The sun was shining into the front windows. A few other servers were bustling around, wrapping silverware and setting up tables. From the kitchen downstairs, Bonnie could hear the murmur of voices, the sound of running water, the banging of pots and pans. There was a shout, some laughter, the closing of a door. In other words, it was a typical Sunday morning at a popular restaurant in St. Louis that had not yet opened for business. Bonnie hurried out of the bar area with an armload of silverware that had been rolled into napkins. She was on her way to one of the rear dining rooms when she stopped in her tracks. A customer was sitting at one of the tables. She was a little surprised because, as far as she knew, the front door was still locked. Well, how had he gotten in? Well, somehow he had, and now the dark-haired man seemed to be waiting expectantly for service. Bonnie supposed she could ask him to leave, but that really wasn't in her nature. And said she'd explain that he would have to wait for dinner service to start, but she would offer him something to drink. So Bonnie placed the silverware she was carrying onto a table and walked into the dining room. With a smile, she explained to the man at the table that they were not yet open for business, but she could get him a cup of coffee or perhaps a glass of iced tea. Well, the man didn't reply. In fact, he didn't even look at her. Bonnie took a step closer, preparing to ask again in a louder voice, and when she did, she looked away, but only for a second. When she looked back at the man, he was gone. The seat at the table was empty. The chair had not been moved for someone to even sit down. In less than 2 seconds, the man had simply vanished. It was impossible, but it happened. Bonnie never got over her encounter with one of the Limp Mansion's resident ghosts. That Sunday turned out to be her last day working there. She put in her notice, and she never went back. She decided, she explained, to find a job at a place where the clientele was still among the living. Welcome to the latest episode of American Hauntings, the podcast dedicated to the history, hauntings, legends, and lore of America's past. Hosted by Cody Beck and Troy Taylor, our second season explores the history, mystery, and hauntings of St. Louis, Missouri, the most haunted city along the Mississippi River. This is the sixth and final installment in our series within a series about the hauntings and history of the Limp family of St. Louis. If you're tuning into the podcast for the first time, we recommend you go back to episode 19, start the series there. It serves as an introduction to the Limp family and their importance in St. Louis history. As we wrap up this part of the series, we'll be delving into the haunted history of the mansion that the Limp family once called home. After the initial haunted history portion of the episode, I'll be talking about some of my personal encounters with strange happenings at the house, which is considered to be one of the most haunted places in the country. The Limp Mansion has always played an important role in the history and legend of the Limp Empire, even though it was not originally built to be their family home. The house had actually been built in 1868 for William Limp's father-in-law, Jacob Fikert. As the Limp Brewery grew and expanded, William built this house, as well as another one for his stepmother, near the brewery. In time, William, Julia, and their children moved into the mansion, and it became their residence as well as an auxiliary brewery office. Although it was already an impressive place, William had the 33-room home renovated into a showplace of the Gilded Age. Always fascinated by new technology, William continued adding on to the house for the rest of his life. A radiator system was installed in 1884, only 5 years after radiant heat was invented. The grand staircase was removed to install an open-air elevator. William's bathroom was dominated by a glass-enclosed freestanding shower that William saw in an Italian hotel and had shipped back to St. Louis. At the rear of the house, he installed three massive fireproof vaults where the Limps stored their art collections, and behind the parlor, he had an atrium built for Julia that was filled with tropical plants and exotic birds. In 1911, the house was remodeled again when it was turned into offices for the brewery. Then it was remodeled yet again in 1929 when Charles moved back home. After Charles's suicide, the mansion was sold and turned into a boarding house. By the 1940s, the house and the surrounding neighborhood were in pretty bad decline. But stories circulated about the boarding house that was once the Limp Mansion. Residents complained of hearing footsteps throughout the house and on the stairs and hearing someone knocking on their door very early in the morning. When they answered, no one was there. It makes you wonder if Charles was still alerting his guests by way of the mandatory 5 a.m. wake-up knock, doesn't it? Whatever the source of the eerie sounds, the story spread throughout the neighborhood and it became increasingly hard to find tenants to occupy the rooms. Thanks to this, the former Limp Mansion was rarely filled. The house's decline continued until 1975 when Richard Pointer and his family purchased it. The Pointers began remodeling and renovating the place, working for many years to turn it into a combination restaurant and inn. But they soon discovered they were not alone in the house. The remodeling began in earnest in the late 1970s, and during this time, contractors reported that ghostly events were occurring in the mansion. Almost all of them confessed that they believed the house was haunted and told a feeling as though they were being watched. They also spoke of hearing unexplained sounds and complained of tools that vanished and then returned to different places from where they'd been left. At one point in the renovations, a painter was brought in to work on some of the ceilings. He stayed in the house overnight while he completed the job. One day, he ran downstairs to tell one of the pointers that he'd heard the sounds of horses' hooves on the cobblestones outside his window one night. Richard Pointer convinced the painter he was mistaken. There were no horses and no cobblestones outside the house. Well, in time, the man finished the ceilings and left, but the story stayed in Richard's mind. Later on that year, he noticed that some of the grass in the yard had turned brown. He dug it up and found that beneath the top level of soil was a layer of cobblestones. During the Limps' residency in the house, that portion of the yard had been a drive leading up to the carriage house. During the restorations, Richard's son Dick lived alone in the house and became quite an expert on the ghostly manifestations. One night he was lying in bed reading when he heard a door slam loudly in another part of the house. Well, no one was supposed to be there and he was sure he'd locked the place up tight. Fearing that someone might have broken in, he and his dog, a Doberman named Shadow, decided to look around. Shadow was obviously on edge. The dog had also heard the slamming door and had her ears turned up, listening for any other noise. They searched the entire house but found no one there. Every door was locked, just as Dick had left them. The incident repeated itself several times. Each time he searched the house and every time, the place was empty. After the restaurant opened, staff members began to report their own odd experiences. Glasses were seen to lift off the bar and fly through the air, sounds were often heard that had no explanation, and some claimed to see apparitions in the hallways and on the stairs. And it wasn't just the staff members. Customers also reported weird incidents. Doors locked and unlocked on their own, the piano in the bar played by itself, voices and sounds came from nowhere, and the ghost of a woman began to be regularly reported. One night in August 1981, Dick and an employee were working in the bar after hours and were startled to hear a piano play a few notes by itself. There was no one around it at the time, and in fact, no one else was in the entire building. That same piano continued to be the source of eerie occurrences over the years. No matter where it was placed in the house, whether in an upstairs hallway or in a guest room, it reportedly played without the touch of human hands. That's an event I can vouch for. I've heard it. The ghostly atmosphere of the house has attracted many visitors over the years, but it's also scared away some of the employees. One of them was the witness in the story that was recounted in the episode's opening. That was a true experience that really happened to one of the staff members, and she left after that day to find work in a non-haunted location. Well, thanks to its reputation, the house has attracted ghost hunters and writers, myself included, from all over the country. Most were lured to the place by the publicity the house received as a haunted location. The mansion has appeared in scores of magazines, newspaper articles, books, and television shows over the years, first gaining national attention in November 1980 when Life magazine included it in an article entitled Terrifying Tales of Nine Haunted Houses. The first local notoriety gained by the mansion as a haunted place can be traced back to the 1970s when it was investigated by the Haunt Hunters, who we've talked about in earlier episodes of the podcast. Phil Goodwilling and Gordon Honer researched paranormal events and haunted locations around the St. Louis area. And as we'll talk about in a later episode, they may have been the basis for the film Ghostbusters. But in the 1970s, they learned about many of their cases while teaching a class on the supernatural at St. Louis University. One semester, they promised students they would take them to a real haunted place and decided that the Limp Mansion fit the bill. In October 1979, they brought the class to the house and invited a local television crew to come along with them. They spent the entire night at the house using planchettes, like the pointers used with a Ouija board but with a pencil on the tip to write out messages from the spirit world to try and make contact with the resident ghosts. The results of the evening were chilling, especially after one group of students who had no knowledge of the house's history received a message from a spirit who identified himself as Charles. He asked the students to help him reach Edwin. Goodwilling later noted that these four students were the most skeptical in the class. In addition, no one who was present that night, with the exception of himself, Gordon Honer, and Dick Pointer, had any idea that Charles had committed suicide there. At the time, the history of the house had not been yet widely publicized. By the time the seance was over, those four students were no longer the most skeptical in the class. Stories of ghosts at the Limp Mansion date back many years, but the haunting has not faded with time. The Pointer family accept the haunting as simply a part of the house's unusual ambiance. Paul Porner helps to maintain the place as a popular restaurant and inn, and he explains that he accepts the ghosts as just another part of the unique mansion. People come here expecting to experience weird things, he said, and fortunately for us, they're rarely disappointed. I first heard about the Lint Mansion and its hauntings back in the early 1990s, when the first and usually wildly inaccurate stories began to appear in the first few ghost books that were available in those days. I first stayed at the mansion around 1993 and have visited many times since then, and like many others, have rarely been disappointed. I've had a number of personal experiences in the house that I would certainly explain as encounters with ghosts. I think I've had every type of stereotypical ghost encounter you may have read about at the Lint Mansion. Cold spots, knocking sounds, footsteps, voices, and the list goes on. There have been a few experiences there that have stood out more than others, though, and I'll talk about those in a minute. But perhaps my favorite secondhand story, of which I was somewhat involved, happened in 2003 when I invited my friend Leslie Rule, a fellow ghostwriter and the daughter of crime author Ann Rule, to come to Alton, Illinois to speak at an event that I was hosting there. She'd wanted to stay somewhere haunted while in the area, and I helped her to make arrangements to stay at the Lint Mansion for several nights. She was really excited at the prospect until she called to make reservations and was told that she would have the mansion all to herself during the stay. Leslie was not as enthused about sleeping in a haunted house alone, and she asked me if I knew of anyone who might consider staying with her. I suggested she contact a friend of mine named Anita, and together they planned an overnight at the mansion. Anita and her 22-year-old daughter Amy picked up Leslie at the airport, and all of us met for dinner. Anita and Amy had stopped by the mansion before dinner, picked up the keys, and turned on the lights in their rooms as a test, Amy explained. Since the lights in the empty house had a reputation for turning themselves off and on, she wanted to see what would happen. When we went back to the house after dinner and found that some of the lights were no longer on, though, she nervously dismissed this as someone playing a joke on them. I wouldn't find out how scared Amy was about staying in the house until after I talked to her and Anita a few days later. Leslie later told me that Amy was very tentative about exploring the house with her and that it took some urging to get her into some of the creepier parts, like the dark and ominous attic, which had not yet been remodeled in those days. To make matters worse, their flashlight batteries unexpectedly went out while they were in the attic, unsettling Amy even further. But as it turns out, perhaps Amy had a good reason to be unsettled. A number of women who have worked in the house and have stayed the night there have had encounters with a female spirit or have heard someone calling their names. Some believe this spirit may be that of Elsa Limp, who, while she did not die in the house, spent a large part of her life there. They were her happiest times, and perhaps she has returned there seeking peace after her death. Regardless of who the spirit might be, though, many women have encountered her, and as it turns out, including Amy. A few days after her nerve-wracking stay, Amy told me that she had been trying to go to sleep next to her mother in their room on the second floor and was having trouble dozing off. After tossing and turning for a while, she turned over and was terrified to see a woman in a long dress standing next to the bed. The woman looked very real, but there was no way she could have gotten into the room through the locked door. Well, before Amy could do or say anything, the woman leaned toward her, placed a finger to her lips in a shushing motion as if to tell Amy to be quiet and go to sleep. The woman then simply vanished. Well, needless to say, Amy didn't go to sleep. In fact, she didn't sleep for the rest of the night. Well, as Paul Porner once said, those who come to the Lint Mansion are rarely disappointed, and I'd have to agree. While not all of my stays at the old house have been eventful ones, at least when it comes to ghosts, I must admit that the vivid sense of history that I've experienced at the place more than makes up for the lack of anything supernatural. If you're a ghost enthusiast or a history lover, I encourage you to visit the mansion of the once mighty Limp family. Their empire may have crumbled long ago, but there's still much to experience as you soak up the ambiance of the days gone by.
There's one thing that the American Hauntings podcast knows about, and that's mothers. We featured a lot of great mothers in a lot of our episodes. Pearl Curran, Julia Lemp, Sarah Moore, Marie Laveau, Jane Mansfield, Tamsin Donner, Delphine LaLaurie, Belle Gunness. Okay, maybe leave out those last two. But what I'm saying is that with Mother's Day coming soon, you need a truly special gift for your mom because, well, she's not Belle Gunness. So let me tell you about MyLifeInABook.com. It's a unique service that literally turns your mom's life story into a book. So here's how it works. Every week, MyLifeInABook.com will send your mom a question in her email, the same way she sends you questions about your dating life or when you plan to give her grandkids. Anyway, these can be pre-written questions about her life or any custom questions that you want to ask. She replies by either typing in the answers or by recording her own voice. Then MyLifeInABook.com compiles all her responses into a keepsake book, and they can create an audiobook that uses her voice recordings, preserving her voice and her stories forever. As anyone who doesn't have their mom around anymore can tell you, having your mother's stories about growing up, being a kid, and overcoming life's challenges will be something that you and your kids will treasure. And let's be honest, your mom has given you a lifetime of stories. This is your chance to give her a very cool way to share them. Honestly, I decided to try this out for myself, and I sent it to my mom, and she's not exactly a whiz at computers, but she still found it really easy to use. My mom might have had a little more unusual childhood than a lot of mothers do, so I'm really glad to have this, and I think you'll be glad to give one to your mother too. So check out MyLifeInABook.com and use the code HAUNTINGS at checkout for 10% off. Create an unforgettable gift for your mom this Mother's Day. That's MyLifeInABook.com and use the code HAUNTINGS for 10% off today.
Richard Pointer convinced the painter he had to be mistaken. There were no horses. Voices, I tell you. Yeah. During the restorations, Richard's sons did. During the renovations, Richard's son Dick lived alone. Did I still mess it up? I still did, didn't I? Oh, well.
Good?
Yep.
All right. Welcome to American Hauntings Podcast, where we discuss history, hauntings, legends, lore, and all things paranormal. You are listening to episode 24, which is the 11th episode of season 2, which delves into the hauntings of St. Louis, Missouri. I'm your co-host, Cody Beck, and with me, my co-host is author, historian, crime buff, and founder of American Hauntings, Troy Taylor.
So are you relieved? Now that we're almost done? At the end of the limps?
Yes.
I thought you probably would be. So it was one of those things that I hated to give up. You know, I hated to let it go, but we finally got to the end of the story.
Well, it's such a positive story. I can understand why it'd be hard for you.
It's so uplifting, right? Yeah, these poor people.
Motivational.
Yeah, very uplifting. So, but it was fun. You have to admit it was a fun.
Oh, yeah.
It was a fun run of episodes.
It's great. It was very depressing in a lot of parts.
Suicides, but, you know, all kinds of
suicide
stuff.
And so, spirits, you know?
Right. Well, anyway, I'm glad that we have finally reached a conclusion to the limps, and we'll move on to some other things as things kind of shake out here with the summer, because I think after this episode, I think we're going to be moving into the Haunted America Conference. And this is the last episode that you're going to hear before the conference. And then after that, it's going to be, you know, we'll probably post our conference episode as our next episode. We'll probably have a couple of oddball episodes in there somewhere before we get right back into St. Louis again, because in addition to the conference, we've got some other stuff going on, some trips, vacations, slash, you know, things going on that are going to kind of, you know, we don't want to take a break. You know, a lot of the podcasts I listen to and great podcasts will take a break for months at a time. We're not going to do that to you, but I can tell you, we probably will not get right into our next St. Louis episode because, to be honest with you, I'm going to need some time to just sit and cry ending all these limp episodes. So I'm going to need a breather. So, but if you are hearing me talk about the conference, that is coming up June 22nd, 23rd. And by the time, you know, you're hearing this, this is your absolute last chance because as of which I believe is, June 18th, that is your last chance to get tickets to the conference in advance and get discount tickets because after that, the price is going to go up. You will only be able to get them at the door. So if you haven't gotten your tickets by the time you hear this, you're going to want to really seriously get on it. And that's assuming we'll have something left because we are recording this just a little in advance. So chances are, you know, I don't know. I can't guarantee we're going to have anything, but I hope we will. And if we do, you really want to get them in advance rather than get them at the door.
Right. And just a reminder, if you like the podcast, you know, this podcast is just one smaller piece of a larger universe. And a lot of
the conference is a big part of
it. Lot of this really builds up to the conference. So if you like what we're doing here, you like these stories and, you know, you think we might be fun to hang out with, the conference is where you want to be.
Or not.
If you want to avoid us, then yeah, don't come to the conference. Yeah. But that's really the big thing that I want to promote.
Yeah, we're going to be doing a live recorded podcast at the conference itself this year. During our Strange Stuff session on Friday night, which is kind of a way for people who attend the conference to kind of share their stories and their ideas and things that they have going on with us. And that's going to become an episode of the podcast coming up toward the end of June. So if you want to take part in that, be there. And regardless, even if you don't want to take part in that, come by. The vendor booth, Cody will have a booth for the podcast. We're going to have our American Hauntings podcast stickers, which you can, our decals you can only get at the conference. Cody will have those at the table, and I think they're probably going to go pretty quick. So make sure that you stop by and visit the booth and visit, pick up a decal, stop by our booth. We'll have the entire store will be there at the conference. We'll also have a lot of stuff that you might not be able to get online because there's just maybe not enough of it. So we kind of bring it to the conference to get rid of it. And don't forget about the raffle this year. We haven't really talked about that.
We haven't. So I know you guys pretty much every year have a contest amongst yourselves.
What's a raffle?
Amongst yourselves, see who can collect the craziest stuff for the raffle.
Yeah.
And last year I won a Ouija board, and there was much crazier stuff there than
that. Yeah, we've got some Ouija boards this year. We've also got a lot of haunted objects, oddball odds and ends. We have embalming kits. From funeral homes.
There was an exorcism kit
last year.
From a
priest we have a ventriloquist doll, like a vintage one, you know, which will wake up while you're sleeping. And, you know, that's, we've got postmortem photographs. We've got
all the good stuff.
Mortuary items, the mourning item made from human hair. We've got a lot of cool stuff this year. It's going to be, I can't wait. I mean, we try to make the raffle bigger and better every single year, but I'm going to say this year is definitely going to be biggest. Oh, and Renee has designed not only a Ouija table this year, but also one that you can hang on your wall, a big massive size Ouija.
Nice.
It's going to be we've got some cool stuff lined up for this year.
That's awesome.
So it's going to be fun.
Right. And I don't know exactly how this is going to work yet, but I'm probably planning on having people be able to stop by our booth or my table and tell me their haunted stories and crazy stuff, and we'll record them and use them for some bonus stuff. So if you're around, I don't know exactly how it's going to work yet, but please stop
by.
Come
tell us a story.
Yeah, come tell me a story.
For sure. I've got some stories for you, Cody.
Yeah?
I'll stop by.
Do tell.
Yeah. Well, I wanted to say, too, about the raffle.
Lisa is here, by the way.
They figured that out already.
They probably figured it out.
They never introduce me, you guys. I get no respect. But I just make sure they have their act together. But I wanted to say, too, about the raffle, that there are some things that are in our office right now that I really need to get out of there, i.e. haunted candlesticks that need to be yours and they need to be in your house.
Right.
The dead man's suit, I don't think it is haunted, but
I'm
no longer comfortable with this being a part of our office.
Candlesticks that someone gave us that were
part of an aunt, I believe an aunt or a great aunt's seance room. And so she had these candlesticks in there, and I got them from her. And she's always said, I think there's some kind of weird energy about them. Well,
yeah, no kidding.
I hadn't told Lisa that I had them. And she's like, okay, what is going on?
There's something's
here.
And
this room. And
I'm as psychic as the table our computer's sitting on, but that.
Yeah. What was
it's
happening?
It's been bothering me. Nothing, it's just an energy that's
vibe.
Really bothering
just
me.
Oh, bad juju?
Yeah, there's bad juju that I couldn't, you know, walk backwards a couple times to get rid of.
Right,
it was, like,
right.
Just there.
No amount of sage burned was
no.
getting rid of this.
Well, we did have to burn some sage for one
else.
Item.
We told that story, right? We did tell
I don't know. I don't
did
know.
Did we? No, that was on our Facebook Live.
Yeah,
right?
No, we drink a lot during this podcast.
I'm
going
to give
don't
that
know.
Back to you if you want to tell about
yes,
that. But I want to tell them,
yeah.
too, that a couple of our other items that I can't wait for them to go home with you. The postmortem photograph, while I'm totally cool with the tradition of it, it is a very good one. It's beautiful. It's lovely. And it needs to be in your possession and not mine any longer. The dead man's suit. And then also a recent addition from my own collection, a mourning dress that I didn't wear in mourning, thank goodness. But I did wear, and I'm going to donate to the raffle this year. So this could be yours. And you can wear it either as a costume or you can go really overboard for your next visitation if you need to.
Yeah, I've forgotten about the object. We had ordered, or we had, somebody had, it was weird. I bought an item.
It was gifted. And
yeah,
it
what,
never been
but
gifted
what was, yet. What was it that, did it come with? I can't
it
remember.
It came with, it wasn't a Ouija board, but it was.
Oh, it was the magic eye. It was yes. the divination. It was this divination thing from the 40s. And it was this
but
vintage
it wasn't
piece.
Just that.
Yeah.
There were some really peculiar
They sent this in a package with this magic eye divination thing that you use like a pendulum with kind mm-hmm. of thing. And it's old. I mean, it was from the 40s and it's part of the raffle. But they also included, when they sent it to me, they also included like some like religious tracts and stuff that went with it. And then they sent this. I don't know how to describe it. It was a crystal and it was like sort of like a lens or something, but it was like a mirror that you would use for like fortune telling, and it came with it and they stuck it in there. And we didn't order it. It came all wrapped up. It was wrapped up in paper and tied with string, which it turned out to be kind of important. It should have.
But instead I'm like, ooh, a something. So I just tear into it. But you're right. It's kind of like a crystal ball because it was concaved on both sides but fit in the palm of your hand. So perhaps it was like your traveler's edition of the crystal ball.
On the go?
Yeah.
Right.
On the go.
But
for the on
it,
the
but
go.
But it was wrapped
second.
In paper and tied with string, which I thought, well, that was weird. I didn't understand why. So we got this thing, and not long after we had it, we had a lot of just, I mean, it was just weird. It was just weird things going on. It was a weird vibe. And I'm not, you know, as Lisa said, I'm as psychic as this table. I'm less psychic than that. I don't ever claim to be psychic, but there was something about this, you know, right after we got this thing. And and I'm telling you this, but we didn't put two and two together for a while. But things just seemed really weird around the office. And finally, I sent a message to Rosemary Ellen Guiley, who is, she is a, presenting a couple of workshops this year at the conference. And I always say about Rosemary that she is one of those people that she has written a book about, you know, everything from A to Z, you know, that kind of thing, from angels to zombies is what I always tell everybody. She seems to have a real knack for everything. And we still really hadn't put anything together. It was actually Andrea Holman. She does a lot of readings and stuff. She comes to a lot of our events. She was at Dead of Winter, and she'll be at the conference, and she does readings for people. And no matter how you feel about that kind of thing, Andrea has always been really, like, on the money for a lot of people. I mean, she's really on the ball for people. And she had told Lisa, and I don't think you had asked for a reading. I think she just sort of gave it to you kind of thing.
No, thank you.
Yeah, she gave it to you anyway.
There's
something
she's
in your
a friend
office,
of mine. I'm glad
right?
That she did.
Right.
So it wasn't, you know.
So it was kind of one of those. There's something in your office, and you know, and while we had been kind of feeling that there was something odd going on anyway, so we kind of narrowed things down to this weird crystal thing that had been sent to us. So I'd asked Rosemary about it, and she said, oh yeah, that sounds exactly what it is. She goes, but she says, it sounds like it's pretty low key. So the best thing to do about it, and here was the clincher. She said the best thing to do about it was to take this object, wrap it in paper and tie it with string and bind it the way someone had sent it to us. And she said, you can give it to somebody if you want. She said, but my suggestion would be just to make sure it's destroyed. Put it into the garbage, make sure it goes to the dump. And as long as it's, you know, tied with paper and string, it'll all be okay.
So somebody passed the buck to you.
Somebody passed the buck to us, and then we passed it to the garbage man. I'm hoping that he didn't pick it up. So I'm going to guess he didn't. But so not everything that we end up getting for the raffle is always good.
Mm-hmm.
So that was an oddball thing. And, you know, I don't think we've only over the years ever had a couple of things. We've had people who've come back to us with stories of things they've taken home for the conference and said, oh, yeah, well, we started having these weird knocking sounds in our house or whatever, that kind of thing. We had an urn one year that had someone's ashes still in it, and I don't know whose they were, but we had one of our regulars take that home and tell me that they started hearing knocking sounds in their house. But normally the people who come to the conference, that's a bonus. I mean, they got a raffle ticket, they got an item, and the ghost that came with it was a bonus.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, we've got a lot of stuff this year, from Ouija boards to, as Lisa said, the dead man's suit. It does not come in a heart-shaped box. Bonus points if you know what that means. But it's just one of those things.
That book.
Yeah,
it's
you
worth
can.
The Google.
Yeah, because the book is awesome.
I was like, is this a Nirvana reference?
Well, there is the heart-shaped box song by Nirvana, and I think that's where the title of the book came from. But if you read the book, you will not be sorry. That
all
is
right.
One of my favorite books of all time.
I will check
in fact,
it out.
It's right over there on the shelf behind you. So,
it is.
See it. It is one of the best books ever.
Joe Hill.
So anyway, we. So come to the conference. I guess that's my thing. This is my last chance to beg you to get signed up for the conference before the conference gets here. You will not be sorry. We have a very limited number of seats left, and this is the event of the year. I mean, it's a lot of fun. We have a blast with it, and I'm really excited about it getting here. And then I'll be really sorry when it's over.
Yeah.
I always am every year. So we have to plan a trip every year once it's over to get over our sadness of the fact that it's over. It's a lot of work, but it's a lot of fun.
I'm really excited.
We'll already be planning for, you know, the conference ends on.
We already are.
I know. Well, we are. Yeah, we already started for 2019. So it's, you know, as soon as it's over, we start planning for next year. But we really love it. It's a fun event. So.
Yeah, I'm really excited for it. I haven't told you two this yet, but my plan is, I mean, I'm obviously very skeptical a lot of times, but I like to be what I would call actively skeptic, so I'm not just sitting there, you know, being a jerk. So my plan is I want to go and partake and go to all of the readings that I can at the conference and be as open-minded as I can and just see what happens.
Yeah, why not?
And talk about,
sure,
and talk about it afterwards, and I'll just let people know what happened, how I viewed it. I will not be mean or snarky or anything. I'll be very open-minded, and I'm just really excited to kind of see what happens because I saw a lot of that going on around me at the conference
last year.
Right, right.
Well, you know,
no idea.
We have a lot of after-hour events at the conference too. I mean, we've got some that I think that people would really enjoy. We've got April doing one on, you know, death traditions and such, connected to the book that's coming out. And she's got a workshop, and I know that Sherry Brake has a workshop that's going on too, and that's about dowsing, which literally just about anyone can do. I don't know if you know much about it or not. That's how in the old days, well, I say in the old days, but people still do it.
Sounds painful.
You can find water. Oh, no, it's not. It's, you can use like dowsing rods or like a stick and find water.
Oh, okay.
You know what I'm talking about?
You've seen the cartoons when you were younger, and it's like that Y-shaped stick.
Most electric, like electric companies and people right now,
they still do it.
I am
100%. It wasn't just a funny thing in a cartoon. Like, it's legit.
I'm very skeptical of this. I want to learn more about it.
Well, it's really interesting because people find, not only do they find, like, sources of water and stuff, but people will also use it to find, like, unmarked graves. They'll use it to find, you know, buried treasure, even.
How?
I mean, they use dowsing. That's the question. I mean,
I got to go to this event, mystery, I guess, to understand.
So, I mean, and Rosemary's got there. She does an event with Black Mirrors where people can kind of communicate with the dead. I mean, that's the theory behind it. And that's a whole story in itself that maybe I'll save for an episode after the conference. Because I decided to try that one time years and years ago.
Yeah.
Tried to set up what they called a psychomantium.
That sounds safe.
Yeah. Oh, well, it really, it turned out to be a very weird experience. So, yeah, there's a lot of cool stuff that goes on. It's not just people giving lectures, and it's not just vendors and tables and stuff. I mean, it's, in fact, we try to make the point of that's not what our conference is about.
Yeah.
It's not a convention. It's not a bunch of, you know, dipwads that were on a TV show once that want to sign a photograph for you. It's not like that. It's a speaker based event. And we've got, you know, some of the, like, you know, we've got some really top name people who are coming to give presentations at this event. Sarah Chavez from the Order of Good Death. I mean, she really, she's talking about, ghosts and which is great. She's talking about ghosts and how, food figures into our connection with the spirit world.
All right.
Colin Dickey, who wrote the book Ghostland, Robert Damon Schneck, who has done a bunch of stuff. And if you go on to Amazon Prime, I think it's Amazon Prime, not Netflix, there's a movie called The Bye-Bye Man. That's actually based on one of his books. So there's a lot of people who are coming. We don't do like a lot of the, you know, TV show people that don't have anything to say. We try to bring in people who are actual researchers who really have, you know, material, things to talk about, not the last time I was on a TV show. That's not really our thing.
Right.
And anyway, enough. We should stop.
Well,
Come see the live broadcast. Come to the conference. If this hasn't convinced you, nothing's going to, so we'll drop it and move on from there. And you can hear what we do at the conference after it's over.
Right.
So,
and I will just say there was every walk of life there last time, and people that believed, people that didn't. There were devout Catholics. There were atheists. I loved it because it was such a diverse group of people. Anyone is welcome and accepted, and it's great. So
absolutely.
I hope to see you there.
Yeah, absolutely. So anyway, before we get started with the rest of the show, let's take a quick break. If you've been enjoying the St. Louis episodes of the podcast, you might also enjoy the new edition of my book, Haunted St. Louis, which lets you take a deeper dive into these stories, plus a lot more stories that we can't cover on the podcast. And coming soon, in fact, it's going to be released at the conference and then will be available on June 26th, is April Slaughter's book, Disconnected from Death, which I was a co-author on. It's a look at America's death customs and rituals, from embalming to postmortem photography, which I think all of our listeners are going to enjoy. Just remember that as an American Hauntings podcast listener, you always get 10% off your orders from our online store by using the promo code PODCAST when you're checking out. And you could see the show notes for the link. Now, on with the show.
So now we're getting into the ghost stories. We're getting into the good stuff people want to hear. So Limp Mansion is eventually turned into a boarding house.
Right. Well, it you know, after Charles's death, it was kind of one of those things. I think that Edwin had wanted to sell it before Charles ever moved in.
Yeah.
After Billy had died, he wanted to get rid of it and just divest of the problem. And Charles said no. He wanted to move in. He wanted to live there. He'd live there most of his life till Billy, decided to turn it into offices. And I think that Edwin always felt that sort of made his brother's problems worse, living in this house. But after he died, he sold it off, and it was turned into a boarding house, because by that time the neighborhood was not good. There was no, the things shift and change.
Yeah.
You know, St. Louis, like any other city, and that whole Soulard area became pretty rough. By the 1950s, up until not that long ago, when it started to revitalize, that was a pretty rough area. I mean, I think that even in the 70s, when the Pointers decided to try to turn it into something, that was a questionable business plan at the time. And I think they had a good location with a good history behind it. And I think that's what made it work. But it's kind of like, you know, the Bissell Mansion, you know, on the north side.
Yeah.
That's a sketchy area. I mean, it can't be helped. That's how it is. That's just how it is. And that's how Soulard was at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And it didn't come back until the last decade or so. Right. And so, you know, turning it into a boarding house was kind of like, you find a lot of historic homes in any town. I don't know where you're listening to this from, but anybody who's listening, you know, has probably got historic homes in a district of town that have been turned into apartment buildings. And this was the same kind of thing.
Yeah.
It was the, you know, it would have been turned into apartments if the Pointers hadn't bought it in 75.
Mm-hmm.
But instead, in 1949, early 1950s, it was a boarding house.
Right.
Same basic idea. So
yeah, so 75, Richard Pointer turns it into a restaurant and an inn.
Well, they started on it. That's when they bought it, they began working on it through the next few years. And it really wasn't an inn. It was a while before it became a restaurant first.
Mm-hmm.
And it took a while. I mean, they worked on it over time. And even after, like in the early 90s, I think was the first time that I had stayed there. And there were only a few rooms available at the time, and there was no air conditioning at the time either. Window units, that's all we had. In fact, I'm not even sure we had window units the first time I stayed. It's been a while. But over time, they have continued to renovate the house.
Mm-hmm.
And for many years, when I was staying there, the attic was completely unfinished. It was, you know, like it had been when it was rooms for the staff, but yet kind of fallen apart because, of course, there hadn't been staff there in 50 years. So things were a lot rougher. And so a lot of the stories that I've got, you know, took place in that attic before it was ever, you know, refurbished. I mean, it's beautiful now. They've got, like, you know, luxury bathrooms and, you know, really nice rooms and stuff in the attic, but it didn't used to be that way.
Right. And we're going to dive into all Troy's stories, sure. promise. But I do want to talk a little bit about the attic. Every time we do an episode, you know, with a topic, I research as much as I can. I usually read your books and source material. I'll also get on YouTube and try and find videos and then comments and things like that. Yeah. There's a video out there. I'm not going to talk about anybody that it is involved, but you can probably find it. But there's something I want to address because there's a man that calls himself parapsychologist. I hear that term all the time. I hate that term. All of a sudden, it makes me upset.
There are a few out there. But it's not really something that
you can test and measure.
Not since like the 1970s.
Yeah.
I mean, that's one of those things that is sort of kind of fallen by the wayside.
Exactly. And so he immediately goes in, doubles down the parapsychology thing and starts talking about Zeke and uses some choice words. And then he jumps into orbs and plasma and all these things that just infuriated me. So,
Well, that was a time capsule of the early to mid 90s when
absolutely.
You know, things like orbs were, for whatever reason, accepted by people as something other than, you know, dust, insects, and light refractions.
Do you not like orbs?
We did cover that, I believe.
Oh, 100
there are
times.
No orbs. Orbs are not ghosts, so we can just kind of leave that alone. But yeah, that was a thing at the time, as was calling yourself a parapsychologist when you have a degree in library science, or you're a doctor in something else and you pretend like that's in parapsychology, and no one has a school of parapsychology anymore. That died out in LA in like the early 80s,
right.
I believe they stopped doing those. So you can get one from the back of a magazine, but it's not for real, or off the internet. I'm not even sure they do that anymore.
I might actually try to get one just to get the certificate.
Yeah. Well, I am an ordained minister.
Right. Yeah.
I got it from the internet. So you can also get a doctorate in all kinds of things, or a professorship, or I don't know, whatever the hell, off the internet. But that doesn't necessarily make you an actual parapsychologist.
Right. Or likable.
Or a minister for that matter. But apparently I can sign things because I've done it.
There you go.
Yeah.
You're like a glorified notary.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you're right. That is exactly what it is.
So. Okay, well, I do want to dive in, though, to your stories. There's a bunch of them.
Let me tell you that the stories were not just – these aren't stories that just appeared in books and in, you know, Life magazine and that kind of thing, because I had a woman come to me who told me, as far as I can tell, it's the oldest Limp ghost story, Limp Mansion ghost story there is.
Okay.
She came to me in the early, it was the early 90s, probably 93, 94. And she came to me with a story about how she had had a, I believe, a friend who'd lived in the house. And this was in 1949. So this would have been like late in the year after Charles had committed suicide, after it had been turned into a boarding house. And they snuck into the house. It was, she said it was vacant. So maybe it hadn't been turned into a boarding house at the time. But they had gotten in the front door and they had gone up the main staircase and they were climbing up the stairs and saw a ghost. And she said that there was a woman who came around the corner and walked to the top of the stairs. And of course, you know, needless to say, they ran for their lives. They were just kids who lived in the neighborhood. But she had never told that story to anybody. She told that to me when, I guess, like I said, it was in the early 90s. And she was pretty old at the time. So this was a story that had been around for a while that she'd kind of hung on to. And as far as I know, that's one of the first ghost stories that was ever told. I'm sure there are others, but that was the first experience that someone had had prior to, you know, the 70s when I, and I talked about it in the story that the Haunt Hunters were there and they were there a couple of different times. But the one that I recounted in the monologue was kind of like their, like the best story was one of the best stories when they were there with the Ouija boards, because that was their big thing. Because back in the 70s, when you did an investigation, that's what you used. I mean, you used a Ouija board and tried to get information from, you know, whatever, you know, ghosts might be there that might be willing to speak. We've talked about the Haunt Hunters in earlier episodes, the police station and stuff when we first started.
I looked
and
for that video too.
And we'll talk about them some more later on, but they're, you know, that night they were there, they had a lot of these students who were coming up with weird things.
These are the SLU students.
Yeah. Okay. Who should not have, you know, or were very skeptical about the whole thing and came up with information that claimed they talked to a ghost named Charles and, you know, who was trying to reach Edwin. And that's weird.
And I mean, at that time, they didn't know about Charles.
Yeah. The students didn't.
Right.
I mean, you know, the Haunt Hunters and Dick Pointer knew, but the students didn't know anything about it.
Right.
And that was the late 70s. So that's how long this place has been on the radar of ghost people. You know, it made that 1980 Life magazine, which, by the way, if you ever run across, has Walter Cronkite on the cover, just to
put
that in a time capsule for you. And it's really not even an article about the Limp Mansion. It just has 9 different houses that are known for being haunted around the country. And it's more photos. I mean, it's Life magazine, so it's more photos than it is information. But that's kind of what put them on the map. After that, I think the first story that I had ever run across it, like in a book, was I believe it was written in the very early 90s, like 1991, was the first, and it was questionable information, as it turns out in hindsight, but it was one of the first times I ever saw it in a book. But I think that it was the 90s, early 90s, mid 90s, when things started to really take off, you know, outside of the St. Louis area. I think around St. Louis, people knew it as a haunted house, thanks to newspaper stories and the Haunt Hunters and that kind of thing. But it was the early 90s when it really started to take off around the country.
And so with this, one of the old, like the oldest ghost story there, you think you have some opinions about the identity potentially of that ghost. Can you tell me a little bit more about that?
I mean, you know, I've heard a lot of, I mean, there's lots of different stories, as you know, circulating about who haunts the house. If I had to pick a couple of ghosts, or I think the main spirit who haunts the house is Charles. I think he's the one most tied to it. Not necessarily even in death, but in life. I mean, this was a guy who had lived there pretty much his entire life until Billy had kind of pushed him out for a few, you know, for a few years where he lived at the Racquet Club. And then as soon as he got the chance, he moved back in. He renovated, moved back in, and stayed there for the next 20 years of his life, next two decades, and died there, committed suicide in the building. So I think if you had to find a particular person who haunted it, it would be Charles. But there have been a lot of reports of women who have been seen in the house. A lot of people who have visited there, who have stayed the night there, claim that they have seen the apparition of a woman. And a lot of people just want to assume that it's Lillian because, and I think they do that because, well, she's got the best nickname.
Mm.
You know, and that was an eye roll I just gave Cody.
You can't see it on the podcast,
but you could probably hear it. She had the best nickname as the Lavender Lady. So a lot of people who, and I'll be honest with you, I mean, you can go out there and scroll around on YouTube, and there are a lot of dimwits who have posted stuff. I'm sorry, but, and Cody just gave me a look.
I don't know.
There are a lot of dimwits who have posted things about the Lint Mansion and who know nothing about the history of the Lint Mansion, know nothing about the family, don't even know what Lillian Hanlon's name was.
And I watched
and yet
all of them.
Will call her the Lavender Lady because that's all they remember. So, you know, because that's all they can remember, well, she must be the ghost. Lillian never actually lived in the house, ever. She, I'm sure, undoubtedly spent time there because, you know, she was married to Billy at a time when the family was still living in the house, you know, before William committed suicide, before Julia died. In that 6 years there, between the time they got married and Julia's death, I'm sure she was in the house countless times, but she never actually lived there, ever. She and Billy lived in a house just down the street, but never lived there. And I don't know any reason why she would haunt that house. I mean, I can't find any reason for it at all. None. I mean, there's zero connection to the house. And that seems to be the key with ghost stories is you need to have some kind of connection to the place that you're haunting.
Right.
And Lillian had none.
It's Ghost 101.
Yeah. I think that if there is a woman who haunts that house, I believe it could be Elsa. She did live there for a good part of her life as a childhood and even part of her adult life. She didn't die there, but it's possible that, you know, she returned to a place, as I mentioned in the monologue, she returned to the place that she probably knew a lot of happiness during her life, you know, before her father died, before Frederick died for that matter. The other candidate would probably be Julia, who did die in the house, who also spent most of her adult life there. Her parents owned it. After her parents, she and her family moved in. She raised all of her children there at the house. She died there of cancer in the house. The house was renovated for her to suit her because, you know, they put in the elevator because she couldn't go up and down the stairs. So she made a huge impact on that house. And so if there are any women who are haunting that house, I believe it would be the two of them. And I'm basing that on, you know, a lot of people claim they have seen an apparition of a woman in period dress. So that might explain who it was. I still believe that any spirits who are in the house, the most dominant one would be Charles. Yes, William committed suicide there, but I've never had anybody who's said that they believe that they've encountered his ghost there. In fact, if anybody had, it would have been his own family. Because that happened in 1904, and they were in the house until 1949 in one way or another. I don't think there was any mention of ever encountering his ghost. Most of the ghost stories came after Charles's death in 1949. So that's who probably I would connect with the house most closely.
So. Yeah, no, that makes sense. And you also have a story from some period during the Restoration.
Yeah, this was a secondhand store. I just like this story.
Yeah.
And I did mention that there was a painter who came in to restore the ceilings in the house. And he stayed all night there. And he's the one who told Dick about the cobblestones, that he'd heard a horse cobblestones.
Right.
This is a different painter. After that, they had actually discovered there was another ceiling that needed to be restored, which is the front dining room. So if you go to the Lint Mansion and you walk in the front doors, directly to your left is Billy's old office. That's where Billy died, in that small room. And they have a picture of a painting of Lillian Hanlon in that room. That's the room where Billy committed suicide. Mm-hmm. On the opposite side of the room is a dining room that was originally a parlor used by the Limps. And it's a pretty large room. There is a fireplace, a big fireplace in the room. And there's also, maybe I shouldn't mention this, but there is actually a little secret compartment on that fireplace.
Okay.
If you find just the right spot, you can actually punch a button and a compartment opens up on the fireplace.
Was there a revolver in there?
No, there's no revolver, but something must have been in there at one time. But I'll leave that. I'll leave that as it is. Mm-hmm. But there is a secret compartment on this particular fireplace. But the ceiling in that room, if you look up, you'll find a pretty beautiful ceiling in that room. Well, back in the 70s, that ceiling was covered with paper. And nobody knew that it had been one of the painted ceilings in the house until some of the paper came loose. They tore it away and realized that there was this beautiful painting that had been done on the ceiling underneath. And so they decided to have it restored. Now, the only way to do this was to bring in scaffolding and bring in a painter who could actually get up on the scaffolding and lay up there and repaint the ceiling, because it needed a lot of touch-up work, because someone had papered over it with glue. And I mean, it was in pretty rough shape, yeah. But you could tell it was going to be something great. So they brought in an artist who did exactly that, brought in his paints, brought in his materials, and would work up there during the day. Well, one day, this particular artist was working on the ceiling and came crashing down the scaffolding and said, "I can't be here anymore. I have to leave," and rushed out the front door and never came back. In fact, he had to send a friend to come pick up his materials. He refused to come back to the house. So, you know, everybody thought, well, that was really weird. So they mm-hmm. had to get this other guy, the cobblestone guy, had to get him back to finish the work that needed to be done. And about a year later or so, they opened the house up as kind of a grand opening for the restaurant. As I said, it was a few years before the inn came along. And they, you know, had a lot of people coming in, a lot of VIP invitations and that kind of thing. Well, they had this old guy who showed up. And he came in the front door, and it turned out he had been a driver for the Limp family back early on. So he was probably in his 80s by this time, and he had been a driver for the family. And he had come in, and they were showing him around some of the things that had been done, the restoration work. And he had walked into this particular dining room, and he looked up at the ceiling, and he started to laugh. And they said, "Well, what is it?" And he said, "Well, you know, it's funny because William Limp had hated the ceiling. After it was finished, he never liked it. And so he had some of the workers paper over it. He couldn't stand the way it looked. So they had papered over the ceiling." And when this artist had fled the house, had been laying up on the scaffolding, he said that he had been lying up there and he'd had this overwhelming feeling that someone was angry. And he felt this like cold chills go through his body. And he just had this terrible sensation of someone was really upset with him, and that he couldn't go on, couldn't work. And this driver had said, you know, this William Limp just hated this painting, you know, and so he had it papered over and he didn't want anybody to ever see it. And it had remained covered until the 1970s. Mm-hmm. Well, finally, this guy comes in, they peel off all the paper, and he starts restoring it, and he has this sudden feeling that somebody's angry and he needs to flee the house. And so, you know, I'm not going to sit here and tell you that I know for a fact it was William Limp's ghost who showed up and you know, right. got this artist to flee the house, but I always liked that story. I always thought yeah. it was a cool story, and it was one that I just always liked.
No, I like it. It's really funny. Yeah,
and like I said, I've had plenty of, you know, my own personal experiences in the house. And I said that in monologue. I've had lots of, you know, weird, you know, we've heard voices and footsteps. And I've been there on lots of nights with mm-hmm. people who claim they've had their own encounters. And, you know, not all of which I can vouch for. But there have been a few that I can vouch for.
Please, yeah, go for it.
My favorite story, and my friend Dave Goodwin was there, so he could vouch for this. Dave, if you maybe have heard us mention him earlier on in the podcast, is a couple of different episodes. He wrote mm-hmm. a book about Jefferson Barracks in St. Louis, which we will get to in the podcast in a future episode. And he was there at the Mineral Springs that night. Dave's a police officer, yep. a military veteran. In fact, he's still in the military, but he did several tours in Iraq. And Dave was there that night when this happened. But one night I decided that I would rent the entire house on the anniversary of Charles Limp's suicide. So May 10th. I know, right? Well, I have also rented the house on the anniversaries of William Limp's suicide. And, you know, you just never know what might happen.
You're just a weird guy.
I rented the house one night in May and had a bunch of friends over. And we decided that, you know, because the early investigations that were done at the house by the haunt hunters, they always involved Ouija boards. We thought it would be cool to take a Ouija board up to the attic. Mm-hmm. And again, keep in mind, the attic was unfinished back then. It hadn't been turned into guest rooms. And so I think a lot of people probably had the same idea. You know, it was unfinished. You could get up there because you'd rented the house, but it was kind of a mess. People had left stuff up there. And I think other people had the same idea because we had found there were a bunch of these like little candles that had been left around and stuff. So we decided it'd be kind of cool to try this. So we went up and we set up a table and we set up a Ouija board, and it was me and Dave and I think a couple of other friends, three or four other friends. My friend Darren was with us, Rex and Amanda. There were several of us up there that day, and we decided it would be kind of cool to try this. So this went on for like 45 minutes and absolutely nothing mm-hmm. happened. I mean, we were, you know, if there's anybody here, you know, we did the everything that you're supposed to do and absolutely nothing happened. And I think that I'm trying to remember who the last two people were, and I'm not sure if one of them was Dave and one of them was my friend. I'm not sure on that. So all I know is that there were a couple of people doing it, and this had been about 45 minutes, and they finally said, you know, I give up. You know, somebody else can try this because I'm not going to do it. And as soon as one of them said that, we heard this noise. And it was like, shoop, like that. I mean, it's the best way I can describe it. And even though no one had been near it, one of the candles that had been left in the room had gone from one side of the room all the way to the other, had slid across the floor under the table where the Ouija board was sitting.
Wow.
I mean, we all heard it. Mm-hmm. And it slid across the room and then saw it. I don't think I've ever seen anything quite like that, ever.
Yeah.
But there were five of us there who saw it. It wasn't just me. Mm-hmm. And all of them, and Dave and Darren, I know for sure, we've all talked about it since then and still remember that. And that was weird. We had another night. I did the same thing. This I think was maybe a year or so later. We did another session. We up there in the attic. There was a group of young guys, and I hear from one of them every once in a while. But a group of young guys, and a friend of theirs who brought them. There were four of them and me, and we had all gone up to the attic, and they were using the Ouija board around a table. And it was one of those nights where they thought they were, you know, things were seemed to be happening. They seemed to be getting some kind of messages. And I'm going to date this back to around 2003 or 4. And the reason that I know that is because I had a brand new, at the time, brand new, it had to have been 2004. And I'll tell you why, how I know that.
Okay.
I had bought a brand new Sony camera. And I had used it, I had bought it using my advance for Weird Illinois.
Nice.
So it had to have been 2004 because it was expensive.
Yeah.
I mean, people have no idea, you know, what we take for granted now, equipment-wise.
What's in your phone and
yeah,
stuff.
Yeah, you don't understand what these prices were like 15, 16 years ago. Mm-hmm. And I had bought this brand new Sony camera, and it was the first digital camera that you could buy that had all of the information that you could use to verify. It was as good as a negative. It was that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
It was a big camera, and it had the very first Sony night shot on it. And that's not going to mean anything to you.
Nope.
But back in the 2000s, night shot was the very first camera you could use for still shots and videos that would show that green looking picture, you know? And it was the only thing you could use with zero light, and it would still work. So I was taking still photographs with this camera of these guys doing this Ouija session. And there is one photograph that came back of it. And there was only three people in the room. And there is a fourth blurry figure standing behind the table.
Yeah, I'm looking at it right now.
And
it's
this
scary.
Was a... And I took this picture and I showed it to the fourth person who was with us, because there were two of us standing outside the room and then the three guys at the table. I showed it to him and he said, "Okay, guys, that's enough. We're done for now. Let's come back to this later." And that was the end of it for that night. And it is a weird picture. And we'll post it in the, I don't know, wherever Cody wants to post it.
Yeah.
The show notes are on the website or whatever. So if you're listening to this episode, We'll have that picture up at the same time we post this episode so you can see it. If you haven't seen it before, I have posted it before, but that was weird.
It looks like a picture, like a thing in a horror movie when something scary like moves back and forth really fast.
Exactly.
You know?
That is exactly what it looks like.
Yeah, it's super
and
creepy.
And keep in mind that except for a tiny little light on the table, it was black. It was zero light in that room except for just a little tiny light they had on the table to illuminate the Ouija board. I mean, I've got some other pictures that illustrates that, but this particular picture of this figure standing behind them was freaky.
The more I look at it, the worse it gets.
Yeah, it was freaky. I think the last experience I had there was with my friend John Winterbauer. John and I were there one night, and we'd had a group there, and it was 4:30, 5 o'clock in the morning, and everybody had left but John and I. And we were kind of going around straightening things up because it was a night and they were going to be open for lunch the next day. So they already had the tables set. So we were making sure that everything was where it was supposed to be. And we were up front in what was Billy's office in the front room. And we heard back in the atrium area that William had built for Julia, you know, with the plants and stuff. We heard glass shattering on the floor. I mean, like a whole bunch of glass shattering on the floor. So we kind of in a panic thinking that maybe somebody had left something, you know, a glass sitting on the edge of the table or something, hurried back there to find out what was going on. When we got back to the room, like I said, everybody was gone. The room was empty. Every glass was exactly where it was supposed to be. There was no broken glass on the floor, but he and I both clearly heard the sound. And that left an impression, I think, on both of us. I mean, we couldn't explain it. I mean, wherever this glass was shattering, it wasn't where we were. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? So it was very strange. So if anybody had to ask me, do I really think the Lent Mansion is haunted? I would say absolutely. Not by any monkey boys. I don't think it's by the Lavender Lady. Mm-hmm. But I do think that the house definitely is haunted. There's definitely a haunted history there, and it may be more than one kind of haunting. You know, we've talked about that too. Mm-hmm. It may be just impressions of the past, maybe explain some of the sounds and the footsteps.
Right,
and
glass.
I think it's a possibility that there is still a, you know, intelligent, you know, viable spirit there, in whether it's Charles or Elsa or Julia, I don't know. Mm-hmm. You know, those are my top candidates, especially Charles, but I definitely do think that. I really legitimately think that Lent Mansion is haunted.
Well, that is a perfect segue into our our next segment here. We get, you know, tweets and emails and things like that from people asking questions, and you've already answered this, so I'm going to go a little bit deeper into it. But the question was essentially, does Troy believe in ghosts, or do we believe in ghosts? Obviously, you do, but can you tell me a little bit more about, I mean, your beliefs, but then also mentioning, we've touched around it before, but what you think is a difference between traumatic history that just repeats itself versus an intelligent entity, or what are your thoughts?
Sure,
on
yeah,
this?
I mean, you know, yes, I do believe in ghosts.
You heard it here first.
Do I believe every story I hear? Obviously not. Otherwise, I would be out searching for records of the Monkey Boy,
right,
which don't exist. So, no, I don't believe every story that I hear, and a lot of times people tell me stories, and I don't know if they're true or not. The people who tell them to me believe they're true, and so I take it as a real story, real as opposed to true. For a true story, for me, it's got to be something I've witnessed myself or experienced myself. A real story is a story that is told to me by a real person. About a real event that they believe really happened to them. That doesn't make it any less true. It's just I can't vouch for it.
Right.
You know, do I think it's a legitimate story? Yeah, 9 times out of 10, yeah, I do. They wouldn't tell it to me if it wasn't something they'd really experienced. But so, yes, I do believe in ghosts because, I mean, obviously I wouldn't have been doing this for 25-plus years if I didn't believe there was something to all this. But, you know, I think there are different types of haunted places. I think there are different types of hauntings. And as I said, we've talked about this before, but in a nutshell, I think that the majority of hauntings, maybe even 90% of hauntings, are nothing more than history repeating itself. It's a haunting in that it is history that has imprinted itself on the atmosphere of a place and then repeats itself over and over again. I think most battlefield stories that you hear are, you know, events, traumatic events, you know, someone died, you know, in the spot, or so much violence happened there that it left an impression behind. We haven't talked about Chicago, but we'll get there eventually. The St. Valentine's Day Massacre story is a perfect example of that. I've always believed that the event that took place when, you know, Al Capone's mob gunned down seven members of the, you know, Moran gang, you know, in this garage, I think it left an impression behind. It was an extremely violent event that happened in a very small confined area. And I think that it left an impression that maybe not all people can pick up, but I believe animals always have, because that's always been the legend about Clark Street. When you come along Clark Street, it was always said that dogs would react to this area. And I don't even know if they're reacting to the fact that these men were killed here, but there was a dog in the garage that day who had a very traumatic, in fact, was so traumatized by the shooting, they had to put the dog down afterward. Damn. So I've always wondered if maybe that dog's trauma left an impression behind, that that's what these dogs are picking up. So that's a bit of a tangent, but you understand what I'm saying, mm-hmm. that I think that most of these hauntings are, you know, an impression that's left behind. And I think that might explain, you know, the footsteps and the noises and things at the Lint Mansion. Now, when people interact with the spirit, when something happens that you can kind of trace to someone actually being there. And as an example, I'll use this as, you know, my friend Anita, her daughter Amy, was trying to go to sleep, and she turns over, and there's a woman standing over her bed at the Lint Mansion, who looks at her and says, "Shh." Now, that's not a repetition of anything from the past. That's a ghost actually interacting with Amy.
Yeah.
And that, I would call that an intelligent spirit. That's a ghost that interacts, like, you know, Charles passing on messages to these students from SLU about trying to reach Edwin. You know, that's interaction. Mm-hmm. You know, that's not an imprint of some kind of history. So that's a couple of different kinds. I mean, I think you could probably go even wider, and there's probably more, you know, different types of hauntings and things, you know, if we continue to go from there. But I think those are the two that you run across the most, especially these impressions, this residual haunting.
Right.
I think that's probably more common than anything else. But to answer your question, yes, I do believe in ghosts. I mean, and I can answer that as a smartass and say, I wouldn't be doing this for 25 years if I didn't believe it.
Right.
Because that would make me a scumbag, you know, if I had been trying to take advantage of people over something I didn't believe. And I do believe in it. I mean, you know, not every single thing that ever happens to me, am I sure it's a ghost? Not every story I ever hear, do I think it's got anything to do with ghosts? But yes, overall, I definitely am a believer, for sure.
Awesome. Well, I'm glad we finally got that the record. No, people ask me a lot now, too. They say, okay, since you've been doing the podcast, do you believe more or less, or what do you think? And I always disappoint them, because I say I actually believe in ghosts less, but here's the caveat. What it is that I think about 80% of, again, I'm not there for these stories people tell me, you know, I can't verify, but I think about 80% of what would happen or what happens is probably a lot of people's imagination run away from, they're in a scary place and they start to build things. I think about 15% of it is probably residual stuff that I think has a scientific explanation that we don't understand yet, but it's still something there.
Right. I think that's a perfect definition of a residual haunting.
For sure.
I'm not sure that that's anything to do with ghosts. We call it a haunting because we can't explain it.
Right.
But I think that's a natural part of our world. Yep. We just don't know how it works.
Exactly. Yeah. And then that last 5% is where I go, I don't know.
I don't know.
And honestly, when you talk about, you know, even the term intelligent haunting or whatever, that stuff, I don't know if I want to know. That's the really scary stuff, you know? Yeah. And so because I will never say I 100% know this or that or the other thing, because I think that's ignorant and I don't want to leave myself open to that. But because I know there's weird stuff that goes on.
There's
stuff I can't explain. And again, I wouldn't be doing this stuff too if I didn't, you know, have some kind of belief.
We've got ghosts, and then we've got all the rest of this stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, we're just dealing with ghosts. Imagine if we started dealing with Bigfoot and the Loch Ness Monster and every other monster that's, you know, tracked through somebody's backyard.
Like the North American Field Guide to Monsters.
Yeah, I can't. Exactly. I can't. I don't even know where to start with a lot of that stuff. And, you know, maybe someday we'll get to some of that. Maybe we'll do a season on that kind of thing.
Maybe.
You never know. But at this point, you know, I think we've got our hands full with ghosts. Yes. And that's hard enough to understand,
yeah.
You know, let alone getting into all the rest of it. So,
yeah,
I agree with you on that.
And I think going along with the theme I was talking about earlier, being more like actively skeptic, I think I need to go to more of these places that we talk about and put myself into those situations a little bit to with an open mind to see kind of what happens, because I want to believe.
Yeah, you know, yeah, you know, right, it's one right, of those. Exactly.
But at the same time, I would never be the guy that walks in and is like, you know, come at me, ghost. Like,
yeah.
I think that's dumb.
No, that is really
asking
dumb.
For trouble.
That is really
whether
dumb.
I believe in it or not, I don't want to know if that.
Yeah.
Like, nothing good ever comes from
no.
confrontation. Like
that. It's like why I still don't want to look in the mirror and say Candyman three times. You know, it's just, I know it's just a movie, but why take a chance?
Yeah,
you
what's
know,
the point?
I mean, why be stupid? You know, so.
Awesome. That's
well,
all
should
have.
We get things wrapped up?
Yeah.
I think we probably should.
Let's
so,
wrap it up.
Anyway, guys, thanks for listening. Thanks for enduring 6 episodes on the Limp family. I hope that you enjoyed it, at least most of it.
Was it only 6?
One of those things. Was it only 6? It seemed like 60. But we really appreciate you hanging in there for it, and we hope you enjoyed it, and we hope that you'll keep listening. As I said, we've got a few kind of special episodes coming up over the next couple of weeks, and we may even have some surprises mixed in with that, too. From some of the locations that we're going to be visiting soon that I don't even want to give that away for you yet, but there's a chance you may have some on-the-scene podcasts coming up from some various places. So we'll see. But we will be back with more St. Louis episodes as the summer goes on. After we've gotten through the Limps, we actually do have a number of other episodes planned before we get to the exorcism, which is going to be
a whole other story,
which I think that you're going to enjoy, because I can pretty much, in fact, I'm going to guarantee you that you're going to hear some things in those episodes of the podcast that you've never heard before, which are actually true, because you can hear some shit that is not true in regards to the St. Louis exorcism, but I'm going to give you some stuff, some firsthand stuff that's never been recounted anywhere before as we come up on the podcast. So I think that you'll enjoy that. So anyway, thanks again for listening. Please, as we've asked you to do before, leave us some reviews on iTunes. It makes it a lot easier for people to find us when they go into search for ghost podcasts or hauntings podcasts. They can find us a lot easier if they have your reviews to build on. So please do that for us. And thank you so much. And I will talk to you next time. And take it away, Cody.
The American Hauntings Podcast is a way to combine historic record, folklore, science and observation, and imagination to uncover more about America's most haunted places, including St. Louis, Missouri. American Hauntings is a bi-weekly podcast. You can hear new episodes every other Tuesday, so please tune in to hear our latest episode and help us take a brand new look at history and hauntings. You can learn more about our podcast and find new episodes on iTunes by searching for American Hauntings or by going to AmericanHauntingsPodcast.com. where we also have links to some of Troy's books, as well as information about his upcoming ghost tours, events, and haunted happenings. As for your host, you can find me on Twitter and Instagram at CodyBeckSTL or at CodyBeck.com. You can find Troy on Instagram at TroyTaylorGram, on Facebook at the Troy Taylor Author page, or at AmericanHauntings.net. This episode of the podcast was written by Troy Taylor, and it was produced and edited by me, Cody Beck. Some of the music in this episode was written and recorded by Charlie Brockes at Lighthouse Sounds in Alton, Illinois.